Hello and welcome to Tantrum, our report on CHMA 106.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Sackville, New Brunswick, the heart of the Maritimes, on the traditional and unceded lands of the Mi'kmaq people. I'm Erica Butler. It's Monday, January 24th. Today's show is packed. We've got local pharmacist owner Charles Beaver telling us about the mass vaccination clinic he's planning with Mount Allison next weekend, targeting people under 30 in need of a booster shot. We talk with Town of Sackville Manager of Special Projects, Kieran Miller, about the town's new emergency alert system, Voyant Alert. And we hear about a new research project that is looking into how we value care workers in partnership with a Mount A researcher and the New Brunswick Coalition for Pay Equity. Public Health is hosting a vaccination clinic today at the Sackville Visitor Information Center with walk-in appointments for anyone 12 and over who has not yet had a first or second shot of a COVID-19 vaccine. The Information Center is also booked on Saturday, February 5th and Monday, February 7th for booster shots, kids shots, and other appointments through the province's online booking system. Sackville will host another vaccination clinic this coming Saturday, geared specifically to help those under 30 get their booster shots. People 29 and under are being given the Pfizer vaccine exclusively due to increased risk for that age group with the Moderna vaccine. Local pharmacist Charles Beaver says he hopes about 600 young people can get their booster shot through the clinic, happening on Saturday in collaboration with Mount Allison University and Public Health. I called up Beaver to hear a bit more. Charles Beaver, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So you've got a kind of big news to share on the vaccination rollout front, another mass clinic being organized in conjunction with the Corner Drugstore and, I guess, Mount Allison University?
Yes, Mount Allison University has offered up space and the expertise of their health center team, led by Cindy Crossman, and we're also being supported by Public Health, who's going to provide vaccinators, some vaccinators for the day.
This is not a general mass clinic. This is targeted, right?
Yes, that's right. There's a large cohort of people, ages 18 to 29, that qualify for a Pfizer booster that we're having a hard time getting done through the pharmacy because of capacity limits. So this is only open to people who have had two doses of vaccine already and are born 2004, will turn 18 in this year, up to age 29.
If you're under 30 in New Brunswick, the province has decided you should be getting Pfizer, right? And then that's because there's a small amount of risk associated with Moderna for people under 30. Is that the logic there?
That's right. It has been shown that there's a slightly higher risk or somewhat higher risk of heart inflammation in the younger population using Moderna. So now it's not that we can't give Moderna to someone under 30, but it can only be done with informed consent. And we recommend against it unless the person has a compelling reason why they want that. And for that reason, and because there are supply interruptions with Pfizer right now, the province has told us that only Moderna will be available to people age 30 and up for the foreseeable future. We don't know how long that will be.
Right. Yeah, it's a tricky thing because you once you open a vial of one or the other, you sort of have to use all those shots. So I guess there's a certain simplicity to saying, okay, this is going to be a Pfizer only clinic and everyone under 30, and we'll just focus on getting that cohort treated.
That's right. And the other reason for doing only boosters is the safety of everyone involved, because we plan to have, well, hopefully 600 or more people through there in a day if there are people unvaccinated or only single dosed. That raises the risk for everyone else. So we can look after the few people that need first and second doses at Corner Drugstore quite efficiently, since there's not that many of them.
In terms of everyone else, if you're over 30 and you have been sort of putting off making an appointment, you can still do that through the corner drug, and almost throughout the entire week you're able to do that.
Absolutely. We have spots open for people to receive Moderna boosters, first and second doses. Throughout the week, we vaccinate almost every day, and have for months now. I will mention that there are anomalies where, as you mentioned, when we open a vial to give a first or second dose to somebody who has to have Pfizer, for example, there often will be two or three doses left. That creates a situation where we have to use that up within a certain number of hours. And, well, last few days, a couple of times we've put our walk-in sign out, and within minutes we're getting phone calls and dozens of requests for that vaccine. But once it's gone, it's gone. So it's not impossible to receive Pfizer when you're over 30. It's just, unlikely.
Charles, how is the rule up and going? This is, everyone's suffering from pandemic exhaustion, I know, and you must be, ahead of the pack in that department. How are things going with Corner Drug and you and your staff?
Well, the team is still pulling together amazingly well. We passed 11,000 doses given, I think it was 8 or 9 days ago. I couldn't tell you where we're at right now. Certainly we get tired just like everyone else does. But it's an emergency. Omicron is surging right now, and we feel compelled to offer booster doses as quickly as we can. And I'd urge anybody who's considering holding out for a certain brand of vaccine, if there's a medical reason why, let us know. Otherwise, it really is not a good idea to wait because your risk of, getting sick with Omicron and single and double vaccinated people just get sicker than people who have had their booster dose. And with the strain on our healthcare system right now, it's very important for people to be vaccinated with their booster as soon as possible.
That was pharmacist Charles Beaver. The clinic that Beaver is planning in collaboration with Mount Allison is happening Saturday, January 29th at the Mount Allison Athletic Center. To register, people must have had two shots of a vaccine at least 5 months ago and be under 30 years old. Appointments are available via the Corner Drugstore website, thecornerdrugstore.ca. The town of Sackville is making the switch to a new emergency alert system, Voyant Alert. I called up Town of Sackville Special Projects Manager Kieran Miller to find out more and started off asking why the town decided to make this change.
So the town started using an emergency alert system called Sentinel back in 2012, and we'd been using that up until recently. And in recent years, we started looking at whether Sentinel still met our needs. So in the event of an emergency, we need to be able to communicate with residents really quickly and clearly. And Voyant Alert is just a much more user-friendly system, both for users and for administrators.
Okay. What sort of alerts will it be used for? I know we're all sort of getting used to the National Public Alert System that blows up our phones every once in a while, that the RCMP have access to, and other sort of like provincial level authorities. But what will this this is sort of an opt-in situation, right? You can choose to be part of Voyant Alert or not.
Yes. Yeah. So the town is using Voyant Alert for emergencies that are impacting us here in Sackville. So yes, as you referenced, the RCMP has an alert system that's kind of at more of a provincial level, but these Voyant Alert emergency alerts are specifically for Sackville and what would be impacting Sackville residents. So the main purpose that we're using Voyant Alert for is emergencies. So this will be something such as extreme weather, a flood, or a snowstorm, or something like a highway closure. As both residents and the town as administrators get more comfortable with the program, it can be expanded to include things like road closures, utility outages, and recycling reminders. And you can even use it for community level notifications about like program and events information. and users would have the ability to edit what kind of alerts they receive. So if you were only interested in using it for emergency alerts, you can receive only those alerts. If you were interested in alerts about community events, you can select that option. But at this stage, we are using it solely for emergencies.
Okay. So would, you know, when the highways were closed, at our last sort of big storm there, the highways were closed both directions, or actually I can't recall if that was two storms ago or one storm ago.
But, I think it was two storms
okay,
ago.
Okay, sorry, I'm getting, they all sort of blend into one experience.
Yes.
So when the highways were closed there in both directions, or the Trans-Canada was closed in both directions for us, would that be something that would have sort of qualified to say, okay, the RCMP has closed down the highways and, or now they're open again kind of thing?
Yes, that's the exact type of situation where we would use Voyant to send an alert for residents.
Okay. So anyone can register. And those of us who have already been signed up for Sentinel, we will, and the emails for this have already started going out, emails and messages that will be automatically transferred over to the new system. Is that right?
Yeah. So anyone that was registered previously on Sentinel would have received a message, a welcome message from Voyant last week on Wednesday.
And what's the coverage like? Do you know how many people have signed up for previously Sentinel, and how many people do you hope to get signed up for Voyant Alert, I guess?
Yeah, currently we have about 1,600 people registered, and with this social media push that we are doing this week, we are really hoping to get a lot more people registered on the system.
Okay. Final question, I guess the perennial cost question, is it expensive, and what's the cost compared to the previous system and that sort of thing?
The cost of Voyant Alert is very similar to Sentinel, and a major advantage of Voyant is that it's a flat rate, whereas Sentinel used a credit system. So if you went over, you had to purchase more credits, and this could be a big issue in the middle of an emergency when we're trying to get messaging out. So Voyant, it's a flat annual rate. There's no limit on the number of messages you send out, which we're really looking forward to as administrators. I mean, ideally, we're not sending out a bunch of emergency alerts, but in the event that we do have to go message it, in the event that we do have to put out messaging, there won't be anything holding us up like there was under Sentinel.
Right, yeah. And so I guess if it's a flat rate, I'm gathering, is it scalable too? Because we're staring down the barrel of amalgamation here. So will this be something you think that we can easily sort of expand to a new Entity 40 level scale?
Yes, we've actually already started those discussions with Voyant. And it won't impact anything in terms of cost. It's the rate remains the same, but we would be looking at, we're working with a KML file with the current boundaries for Sackville, and when that changes, then we would just give them a new file, and the system would be updated for the new Entity 40.
Wow. Okay, that's great. Well, thanks so much for telling us about this, Karen. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Erica, and I would encourage all our Sackville residents to sign up for this.
That was Kieran Miller, Manager of Special Projects for the Town of Sackville. You can check out Voyant Alert from links on the Town of Sackville website or chmafm.com. Finally today on Tantramar Report, the pandemic has shown a light on issues with how we care for each other on an institutional level, forcing us to ask questions like, is the care we provide to vulnerable people adequate and up to our community standards? A Mount A researcher and her partners in the New Brunswick Coalition for Pay Equity are now looking into the flip side of that question, focusing on the working conditions of the 10 to 12,000 care sector workers in New Brunswick. Dr. Rochelle Pascoe-Delaurier is launching her research project this Wednesday in a webinar featuring a panel discussion and keynote address talking about how people value care work here and internationally. Pascoe-Delaurier and New Brunswick Coalition for Pay Equity Director Joanne Perron joined me to explain their project and the state of care work in New Brunswick. I want to start off just like defining our terms. What do we mean when we talk about care work? Who are we talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about all the work caring for people living with a disability or mental illness, senior citizens, people who need some support to get by. So it can be services that are provided in the homes or services that are provided in the residential environment. It represents 10 to 12,000 people in the sector. We estimate that at least 90% of them are women. The wages currently are $14 to $16.80 an hour, which is very low. We did a pay equity study that showed that pay equity, fair pay, would be between $20 and $26 an hour, depending on the services. So there's a big discrepancy between the value of this work and the pay. And I would add the working conditions. Many of them don't have, for instance, any sick leave, paid sick leave. So during COVID, that was a major issue, you can imagine, because a lot of the workers were saying they were worried about the people they cared for, but at the same time were asked to leave work, even if they had a sore throat that could not have been COVID, but without pay, and wait for 10 days at the beginning of the pandemic. So, very difficult working conditions, low pay, people who really care about their work, but often quit because they feel that, well, they do have to feed their family and take care of themselves. And so it's an important sector, but often undervalued. And even though during the pandemic we talked about it a lot, and we did improve the wages, but we're still far from fair pay for the sector.
You mentioned that, some of the pay has improved in the pandemic. There has been top-ups offered, but those are temporary, right?
You're right. You're right. There has been twice top-ups, and they were temporary. Actually, this is the second time, and it's going to end in mid-March. So it's definitely not the same as paying those jobs at their fair value. There has been increases in the base wages. Really, those jobs were paid close to minimum wage for the longest time. So, $14 to $16.80 is actually an improvement. So that tells you how far back, how far, how much improvements was needed, but is still needed.
One of the other challenges in the caregiving sector as well is that it's what we would say is a fragmented sector and institutionally complex. It's made up of a large number of agencies who do this work, and the vast majority of these organizations are very small. They would be what we would call small to medium-sized enterprises. They are some of them in the for-profit sector, some of them in the not-for-profit sector. And so this means is that you have a patchwork, if you will, of services that are engaging with a vulnerable population, an aging population, and in fact, in many ways, a vulnerable workforce because of the working conditions that Joanne has talked about. And so while in other contexts, we would look to in the human resource management world, I should say, we would look to employers as the main agent for improving working conditions. That assumes that employers are in the position that they can implement those changes. And while employers in the care sector do make choices that impact the design of work and employment conditions, they also have some very specific institutional constraints. For example, small and medium-sized organizations tend to lack the resources and the capacity to fully undertake a suite of workforce development type programs or other HR practices. The outsourced nature or the arm's length delivery, where the service is funded in part or in full through various transfers or contract arrangements through government, shapes the patterns at which people are looking for services, and therefore the patterns at which work is available. And so there are features outside of just the traditional employer's control that shape how work is structured and designed in these types of organizations. And so this adds multiple sources where workers might interact with those tensions, right? So it's not just, I have a very demanding job because the nature of the work is very demanding. But when we think about the impact of, say, per diem rates or per hour of service rates, when we think about restrictions on how long people can spend with particular users because of the payment model, this adds pressures that then get exerted on how people perform their jobs, right? It adds time pressure, it adds pace pressure. And so these are all factors that then impact the conditions under which people work that may or may not be in the immediate control of the employer.
Right. And I suppose in a way, like the pressure on even increasing wages for individual employers, that's one of those things where we see in the economy, it takes quite a while for that market adjustment to happen, right? If you start to lose workers, it's not like the pay increases overnight to respond. It's not the same as when, you know, the price of milk goes up. Those adjustments in the labor market happen really slowly, it seems. And so they're not responsive, I guess.
Yes. And on top of it, they depend a lot on government investments, public investments, really. And that is not responsive. You know that it's really a one-year cycle, and it's a lot depending on political will, what is, you know, the priority of the current government. So we've seen improvements in the past few years, but because they started so far back, the wages have been really neglected for the longest time. We still need to focus on that and make sure that future investments really allow eventually the sector to pay fair wages.
And this is where the debates about what's happening in other countries really comes into effect, because there is research and increasing public policy debate in some other countries about the relationship of the state as both the one regulating employment, funding it, as well as regulating the quality of the care that people receive, right? So they exist in this multifaceted relationship with what happens in the care sector. And so other governments have looked at changing the way that we talk about employment practices or minimum wages or adding a living wage to contracts that involve the public sector, or looking at the inclusion of strategies to think about fair working conditions in procurement, for example. And these become measures that then are baked into the contract that set out, this is what it's like to fulfill these government contracts. And so we don't really have that debate happening here at the moment, but these are spaces that we can turn to other countries and say, well, what are they doing to address the role of the state as the funder, the one shaping employment, and the one managing and regulating the service that's being requested?
The undervaluing of care work has been probably around a long time, but would you say that this question is now getting sort of its fair airtime?
So the pandemic, I think, has certainly brought public attention to the care sector and care work in society and how important it is for the economy. And it's also really highlighted the shortcomings and the gaps in our current model for delivering care. And that's not unique to New Brunswick. We've seen that elsewhere in Canada and certainly around the world, actually. And so the sector has actually had longstanding concerns in terms of worker shortages, low retention rates, and very low wages and undervaluing of work in terms of how people are paid. And these things have been exacerbated by the pandemic. And as a public, I think in the pandemic, we've been hearing and talking quite a lot about issues that impact care and the quality of care that people receive, the availability of care. But I think what it's not getting as much attention is some of those root causes, which are these workforce concerns. And so when we're talking about how do we improve care, how do we improve the availability and the delivery of care, or protect the delivery of care, as we've been saying in the pandemic, really these are actually questions that come back to work and employment for the people that are in these jobs. So we're thinking about questions about what skills do they have? Are they staying in these jobs? What is the pace at which they work? How many people can they care for within a given shift versus, and especially as we consider the additional requirements of complex needs and additional cleaning and protection measures, how much discretion can people use in how they support the people they're caring? What is their commitment and ability to be at work and the locations of work when the care is needed? And so all of these questions about how care is received are, on the flip side, questions about how care is delivered and what that employment looks like. And that piece, I think, is getting less airtime and I think is really important to the question of quality of care. And quality of employment and quality of care, I see, is going really hand in hand.
Rochelle, when do you, so we should say this webinar on Wednesday, this panel discussion followed by the keynote, is going to kick off this longer research project. When do you expect, Rochelle, to be sort of reporting back about, you know, about some of what you find out in this research project?
Yeah, so this project of work is happening in a couple of stages. So the first stage that our research team has been and working on at the moment, and I have to say, I need to give a shout out to Riley Livingstone and Sarah Ann Strong, who are working with me at Mount Allison University on this work. So we're doing a review of the international policy and academic work that is current in various care sectors. So we've selected some countries that have some comparable work and comparable structures to review. And so that is the first part. And we'll be taking a draft of that to our steering group, which includes Joanne Perron as the chair, and as well as employer and employee and union representative, representatives from Social Development New Brunswick, industry experts, and Professor Patricia Finley, to give us some feedback on what we think are important things to take out of that international review for applying to a New Brunswick context. So that second piece is then understanding the multiple delivery models that we have here in New Brunswick and trying to apply some of the knowledge that we've learned from that international review. What we hope to do with that is to come up with some short guide documents, almost how-to guides, that might lay out some different actions that or policy approaches that different actors, so whether that be employers or government or industry bodies, for example, might think about or engage in to start to give us a path, if you will, in the direction of considering this type of work. So it's a very short project. It's currently slated for just 1 year. And so we're expecting to be able to report back by the end of this calendar year. This project is not going to cover or fix all of the challenges in the care sector. So just to set some expectations. But I think it does raise really important conversations about the joining up of aspects of the models, and also raises important conversations about tapping into knowledge and experience of what other places are doing and how that might apply here. So we see this as hopefully the first step in a long trajectory of work that needs to be done, but also one that builds on a long historical trajectory of work that the sector has been doing.
That was Dr. Rochelle Pascoe-Delaurier of Mount Allison and Joanne Perron of the New Brunswick Coalition for Pay Equity. To attend this Wednesday's online panel and keynote address, follow the links at chmafm.com or check out the New Brunswick Coalition for Pay Equity on Facebook. That's it for CHMA's Tantramar Report for this Monday, January 24th. As always, we hope you'll get in touch with your comments or questions at news@chmafm.com. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.